This week, the young, extremely ambitious, and terribly clever artist Fahamu Peku is here to talk about his paintings and the project that, as I understand, perhaps led to the paintings, or it could be the other way around, so we're going to wait and perhaps he will clear that up tonight. He was born in Brooklyn. He earned a BFA in painting and digital media from Atlanta College of Art, where I believe he's still in Atlanta working today. Right out of school, he started Diamond Lounge, a design business that, as I understand it, provided him with the revelation that led to the campaign, Fahamu Peku is the shit. Again, something that we will learn more about tonight. But one of the results or elements of the campaign is a series of paintings or a body of work in which Fahamu inserts himself into the art world, giving himself celebrity status by painting his image on the cover of highbrow art and cultural periodicals such as Art Lies, which I hope you picked up tonight. That has his image on the cover. Very nice of Art Lies actually to come and give those out tonight. I appreciate that. These paintings, as well as performances, videos, and the like, are propelling Fahamu to the stardom he is inventing and critiquing through his work. It's really quite compelling. As I said, ambitious and terribly clever. It has meant a very active exhibition schedule, including representing the Panamanian Artist Collective Taller Portobello in conjunction with the 16th annual Ibero-Americano Festival in Cadiz, Spain in 2001, participating in Arts, Beat, and Lyrics at the High Museum in Atlanta in 2005, an exhibition in Barcelona, Spain in 2007, and in Cape Province, South Africa, and at the Austin Art Museum in 2008, as well as recent solo exhibitions such as the show that many of you saw last fall at the Conduit Gallery, where Fahamu is represented in Dallas. Fahamanon, next, Chicago, the title of an exhibition in 2008, and Million Dollar Baby in 2007, which were at Lion's Wear Art Gallery, where he is represented in New York, and Neo Popular Demand at M&M Galleries, where his work is represented in San Francisco, and as I said, this is just to name a few. There is also the limited edition publication, Fahamanon, Volume 1, which I have to say, it really puts it together or breaks it down. I'm not sure which, but it's beautiful. I'm so impressed with this publication, as I am with this young artist and the career that he seems to be designing and making happen. And with that, I want you to join me in welcoming Fahamu Peku.
Hello, everyone. Oh, man, I guess I'm talking to myself. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Thank you, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I would really like to thank Terry Thornton and Fort Worth Modern, as well as Conduit Gallery and everybody who kind of helped put this together. It's a big honor to be here and to present my work to you guys. I would like to start off by showing you guys a very recent video. And you have to forgive me, I'm a little nervous about this one. I literally finished it maybe an hour before I got on the plane. So if you want to throw eggs or anything, I think you might not want to do that. That might not be a good idea. But you guys feel free to let me know what you think at the end of this. And this piece is called Behind the Canvas.
On this edition of Behind the Canvas, we get a glimpse into the mind of an artist. Throughout history, we have heard and seen the legacy of many great artists: Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, Pablo Picasso, Andy Warhol, but no legacy is permeated like that of Fahamu Peku. He is the shit. So now the interview you've been dying to see. Miss Katie Mann, that's me, goes one-on-one with Fahmu Peku, that's him. And as you'll see at one point in our conversation, we get wet. At first, you might think it's easy to figure out Fahmu Peku. He's got the cigars. Look at that. What a big cigar you have.
Well, you know what they say about a big cigar.
The girls. It seems you're always surrounded by these beautiful, intelligent women. And the swag.
I'm a full package, Miss Katie, man. I mean, if I can't make it using my full talents, might as well get a real job like everybody else.
But this tough-talking painter insists that what you see is not necessarily what you get. Can you take us through a typical day for you?
I wake up like everybody else, throw my pants one leg at a time like most people. The only difference, I'm wearing.
And fans of Fahmu, get that. His art shows are the stuff of legend. Throngs of fans, collectors, artists, and dignitaries all come out to get a glimpse of Fahmu's works. His shows generally sell out before they open, making him one of the nation's most sought-after artists. But with 3 to 4 solo shows a year, an array of group shows, parties, and events, one is forced to wonder, where does he find the time to do all of this?
I've been told that you work really fast. You've been known to complete an entire painting in just one sitting. Do you always work at such a feverish pace?
Actually, I do slow down for some things.
Fans like Ian Ford, celebrity badass and underwear model, love Fahmu and his break-all-the-rules approach to his work.
Fahmu Peku is the future.
They know that in this world of elitist-minded artists and institutions, Fahmu keeps it real.
I keep it real, Miss Katie Mann. I mean, I feel like art is more about feeling than thinking. You know, when I paint, I'm trying to touch you in that special place that makes you feel good on the inside.
The fact is, Fahmu's art does make you feel something, a special something. But it also makes you think. And thinking is just not something we're used to doing when it comes to this kind of art.
You are not the typical artist. You don't shy away from the spotlight. You don't have a chip on your shoulder. You read. You smell nice. How is it that you can be this and that?
I'm a gangster.
What does that mean, that you're a gangster?
What that means is, I do what I want to do. Nobody can make me do anything that I don't want to do. You see, I got mind control over y'all. You tell me what to do, I do it. But when you leave, I do what I want to again.
And you'll never guess what Fahmu wants to do next.
I want to be a professional whistler. I mean, like, I'm pretty good at it right now, you know, but I'd like to be, like, you know, even better.
So you are recording an album? A whistling album?
Yeah, it's called Wet Your Whistle. I'm doing some covers of, like, jazz standards by, like, Coltrane, Miles, those kind of things.
Wow. That sounds amazing.
Yeah, you know, it's going to be dope. I mean, some of the joints, I'm whistling in 4-part harmonies.
Our sources tell us that you spent a little time in jail. How has that experience affected your work? Did you shank anyone? Or better yet, survive the shanking? I saw in Oz that happens a lot in prison.
Jail was an arduous experience for me, Miss Katie Mann. I mean, if I had known my license was suspended, I would have taken care of it long before. You know, those 2 hours I spent in that private holding cell was enough to show me that the thug life was not for me, so now I always pay my car insurance on time.
You smoke a lot of cigars. Are they really cigars? Or are they those marijuana-filled cigars the kids are smoking these days?
Look, Miss Katie, ma'am, I have asthma and cataracts. I got doctor's history. I don't owe anybody any explanations, okay? All right? Look, let's just get one thing straight, okay? Crack is cheap. I make way too much money to smoke crack, okay? Let's just get that straight, all right?
But I'm just asking.
Show me a receipt. Show me a receipt where I bought some crack. Show me a receipt.
Now that you're back, let's talk about something more pleasant. I recently read that you're married and have two children. Do you have any outside children or the strange baby mamas?
No, I make it a point not to talk to or accept candy from strangers. One action.
Do you think you are a good role model?
I'm not a role model, Miss Katie. I mean, spokesmodel, they get paid pretty good. But role models don't mean anything. I mean, I don't see the point of setting a good example for somebody to copy what I did for free. Shit, I did all the work.
Your book, Bahamanon, has received rave reviews from the public. I understand you orchestrated, designed, and published it all by yourself. Can you read us a little bit?
Sure. Hip-hop has always been about having a voice and having that voice be heard. Peku's art bravado is a direct reflection of that desire to be heard, or in his specific case, seen.
That was so good.
You can read!
Some people have described that the you in the paintings and the you in person are like two different people. Do you feel that is an accurate interpretation?
You know, I'm not one thing or the other, but I guess I'm just all that and then something.
All right, that was that, guys. Like I said, that one is pretty new, so we might have a little bit more work to do on it. But, you know, basically the idea was addressing some of the sort of observations that I get when I'm out and people have a hard time, you know, seeing the me that you meet in person with the me that you encounter in the paintings as being one and the same. You know, so I always find that to be a very interesting thing, and I wanted to kind of make a comment about that and about the sort of one-dimensional perception that a lot of people get, particularly of black men in media and hip-hop stars, you know, even more specifically. And so that piece is kind of dealing with that a little bit. But I'd like to kind of take it back for you guys a little bit and talk about the series and how it came to be and go through some of the pieces and maybe break it down for you guys a little bit as to how I arrive at, you know, a final work. This is the first piece from the series. It's called Contemporaneo. And at the time, I was when I first started the Fahamu Peku is the Shit campaign. The impetus for doing it was really frustration. You know, I graduated from college, and you know, I was doing all the things that people told you you're supposed to do in order to get gallery shows. I was sending, you know, slides to galleries and, you know, calling, and I would never hear anything back. And I started thinking that maybe, you know, maybe it's because they don't recognize my name, or maybe they can't pronounce my name and they don't want to have to, you know, deal with that. And so I came up with the campaign for Fahamu Peku is the Shit as a way to brand myself and put my name out there in a way where people would see the name and then they would maybe put two and two together. And as I started doing that, I started doing stickers and t-shirts, and I would just give them out to friends, and they, you know, people would see the stuff out, and, you know, the response was always very favorable. But at a certain point, I started thinking about magazines and how when you see somebody on the cover of a magazine, you're thinking, this must be somebody important. I need to know more about them. They're on the cover of a magazine. And so I was at a party, and a friend of mine took this photo of me, and I took the photo, and I made up this magazine called Contemporaneo. And I actually did a postcard for this magazine, and on the front, you know, it says, if you you know, take this postcard, fill it out, and send it in, you'll get a free copy of Contemporaneo. Of course, the magazine didn't exist at all, but I would go to bookstores and slip these into magazines. And one day, I get a call from my uncle in New York. I use my family's address in New York, and I get a call from my uncle. And he's like, I keep getting all these postcards with your face on it. What's going on? And so, but it was at that point, I saw the image, and I was like, this is really cool. I think I'm onto something. I'm going to paint this. And so this was the first painting, and it looks exactly as the piece that I mocked up. And from there, I started to experiment with the idea a little bit more, and I came up with this piece, which is called Surviving Basquiat. This is the first attempt at, you know, using this sort of graffiti and writing and the pieces to also express some of the ideas that I was dealing with in the paintings. And in particular, when I did this piece, I had just finished reading the biography of Basquiat. And I was really moved by it, and really moved by the fact that a lot of the social issues that Basquiat was dealing with as an artist and being a black artist in America hadn't really changed that much. And I thought that was really interesting. But then there's also, you know, this idea that artists often get compared to or put into the box with other, you know, artists of a like genre. And so this piece, Surviving Basquiat, was about understanding what Basquiat went through and where he came from, but at the same time not falling victim to the same trappings that he fell victim to. And that idea has kind of stayed with me throughout the course of the series, this idea of surviving Basquiat. That photo again was another photo somebody had taken at a party. But this piece is actually the first time when I began to orchestrate the images a little bit more, and I hired a photographer to do a photo shoot with me, specifically for the purpose of mocking up these magazines. This piece is called Touching Souls. What I would do is have a photographer do a photo shoot based on specific ideas that I have, and we go into a studio and we just shoot, and then I'll pull the best images and make the covers. This is another photo shoot. This piece is called One Day It'll All Make Sense, which is also the introduction, I think, more specifically of like hip-hop lyrics and hip-hop titles, references in my work. In speaking about these particular ideas, I reference the writing that I use as a form of sampling. And if you're familiar with hip-hop music, you know, a lot of the way the music is put together is through samples. You take bits and pieces from different sources and you put them together to compose something completely different with it. And so I would, you know, create these paintings, you know, very specifically trying to create images that were really flashy and glossy to really kind of lure you in, but then use the graffiti to kind of convey the message and the ideas that I was dealing with. And then I call that sampling. This piece, Say My Name, was a very interesting piece. This was one of my first reaction pieces. I did a show in New York. It was in a hotel fair. And if you've ever been to one of these fairs, but you're literally given a hotel room. And you can put your work up and people can come into the room and experience your art. And while we were in this hotel, on several occasions, people would come in, stick their head in the door and be like, oh, this looks like Cindy Sherman. Oh, this looks like Kehinde Wiley. Oh, this is like, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I was offended, you know. And I was like, my work is like none of these people, you know. And I didn't want people to say, hey, here's another Kehinde Wiley. I wanted them to say, hey, there's Fahamu Peku. And so this piece, Say My Name, was about that. And, you know, the whole thing with the boxing was about combating, you know, some of the stereotypes that I might have to deal with. But as you see in the right corner, it says stuff like Kehinde Wiley was not here, Cindy Sherman was not here, you know, stuff like that. This piece is one of my favorites. It's called Superficial. And I was talking to someone earlier today, and I was kind of explaining to them that when I'm actually painting, a lot of times, the titles for the piece actually come to me at the end of the painting. You know, I just work and do the piece. And while I'm working, I'm always listening to music, all kinds of things. And in this particular case, I was listening to Kanye West's album, and he has a line that says, "Damn, Kanye, it'd be stupid to diss you. Even your superficial raps are superficial." And I thought that was, I just thought that was like a really dope line. And so this piece is called Superficial. I always have to tell this story about this particular piece, but this is from, this is a candid shot that was taken at a show at the High Museum of Art in Atlanta. There's a group called Art, Beats, and Lyrics that goes around the country, and they do these hip-hop inspired art shows. And this was the second one that they had done. It was a really big deal. It was the first time that the High Museum had opened its doors up to an event of this kind. And they came with a whole grocery list of stipulations about things you could and couldn't do. And one of the things was, you can have an art show here, but you can't put anything on the walls. Which we found very interesting. But they gave us the lobby of the High Museum to do the show. And we took that to mean, well, if we can't put the stuff on their walls, we'll just have to build our own walls. And so all the artists got together, and we worked in a studio building these temporary walls that we can transport. And, you know, I'm working on my wall. I've spent a lot of money on getting this stuff done. And the guy who's organizing the show has overcommitted the show. He's told pretty much everybody who can draw in Atlanta that they can be in the show at the High Museum. And he calls me in the ninth hour, and he says, "You know what? I got too many people. You can't be in the show." And I'm like, "What do you mean I can't be in the show?" And he's like, "Well, we got too many people, you know, so you can't do it." And I was like, "But I've already built my wall. I've spent my money. Like, I have to be in the show." And he's like, "Well, you can't be in the show." And I'm like, "Well, I'm at the studio now." He says, "Well, I'm coming to the studio, and I'm going to put a stop to this." And I said, "Really now? I'd like to see how you're going to do that." So it got a little heated, but we eventually worked it out. But by the time the show came around, I was so upset that I said, "Not only am I going to be in the show, but I'm going to take over the show." So this was the birth of actually the character for Hamu Peku is the Sheikh coming to life. And I hired a friend who's a bodyguard. His name is Big Daddy. He's like 6'8", 300 pounds, humongous guy. I asked my friend Honey if she would be, you know, my escort for the night. And so I made arrangements with some of the security guys at the museum to give me, you know, special access. So during the event, there's a line wrapped around the building. We show up fashionably late, and we're wearing dark glasses. It's night. We got on, you know, big coats, and we pull up, and the security comes down and meet us at the front, and they walk us ahead of the line inside the museum, and everybody's looking like, "Who is that guy? Like, who?" And all night, I refused to speak to anyone. If people wanted to talk to me, Big Daddy would keep them at bay, like, "You can't talk to Mr. Peku." And at the end, the next day, there was a big article in the newspaper about how, you know, this show had transformed the, you know, the High Museum. And they had about, you know, five lines about the show, and the rest of the article was about me walking around with a bodyguard. And the legend was born from there. This piece was another reaction piece. Oftentimes, you know, as black artists, you get lumped into these shows that happen only in February. In February, there's like a big cattle call for all the black artists to come out. I had been invited to be in a Black History Month show with another friend of mine. And she was really upset about it. She was offended. And I was like, you know, this is a time that we can actually use to educate people, that, you know, we do art outside of, you know, February. And I did this piece, and it's called "It's Not Even February, Damn." And the whole idea about it is that, you know, again, that, you know, art for black people happens outside of those 28 days. This piece, "How I Got Over," another one of my favorites. But, you know, it happened in a really kind of weird way that the ideas came together. But I was looking at this magazine, Art in Australia, and I was trying to think of, what do I know about Australia that I can reference in this work? And the only thing that I really could speak on is a film called Rabbit Proof Fences, and I'm not sure if you guys have seen that film. It's a film about the colonialization of Australia and how when the British people would move into Australia, at a certain point they were kidnapping young Aboriginal children and taking them to these almost like concentration camps where they would raise them to be servants and stuff in their homes. But ultimately the goal was to breed the Aborigine out of these people. And so the story of Rabbit Proof Fences is about these four little girls, two sisters and two cousins, who escaped from one of these concentration camps and walked like hundreds and hundreds of miles back to their village. And there's a fence that ran along that separated the colonists from the Aborigines, and it was called a rabbit-proof fence because you're not supposed to be able to get up, you know, around it. And after I did this piece and I put in rabbit-proof fences, I started thinking about how I got over my own rabbit-proof fences, and how, you know, I'm using my work to sort of circumvent, you know, the barricades that have been put up around me in my own personal career. This piece is called The Great Black Hope, and this was after my first show in, the first time I came to Dallas, and I saw this magazine, Brilliant, and I wanted to do something that was, you know, Texas friendly, and Brilliant was one of those magazines, so I kind of did that. But it was my first time also experimenting with doing a black and white painting. This piece is called I Ain't Been Shot a Whole Bunch of Times, which is another line from a hip hop song. And let's see, this is John Henry, and this piece, you know, makes reference to the legend of the folk hero John Henry, and it's also a reference to the film Basquiat, where there's a scene where Basquiat's character is in a debate with another guy about whether John Henry was a hero or if, you know, he died in vain, and I started thinking about that again in my own work, and, you know, this idea that, you know, a lot of times people become martyrs, but, you know, is it really in their benefit? Has it really made a change in life if you die in the process of getting where you're trying to go? So this is kind of a tribute piece. Another one of my favorite pieces. This is Hustle and Show. And my good friend Bill Bounds, who was living in Atlanta at the time, plays the chauffeur in this piece. Bill is actually the first person to ever show my work in Atlanta. He gave me my first show, which was very interesting as well. Another interesting story, in that we were both living in a neighborhood called Castleberry Hill, where there's several art galleries. And I had gone to every single gallery in that neighborhood and tried to present my work, and everybody's like, yeah, yeah, cute, but no. And I'd never actually made it to Bill's gallery, which was right across the street from me. And the night of that show at the High Museum, or the day of that show at the High Museum, I saw Bill jogging, and I asked him if he would wear one of my t-shirts to the opening, and he agreed to, and he came into the studio, and he saw the paintings, and he was like, you did these? And I was like, yeah. He was like, you gotta put these in my gallery. And I said, okay. And that was it. So we went from there. This piece is called The Dumb Are Mostly Intrigued by the Drums. And again, it talks about, you know, this piece is another reaction piece where I was reacting to criticisms that I was getting about the work, where I felt that people weren't actually getting what I was talking about in the work. Like, they were just caught up in the hype of it. They were, you know, caught up in the flash of it. They thought it was fun and funny, but they didn't really realize that there was something more to it than just a guy smoking a cigar in a suit. And so this piece was actually one of the first pieces that I did that was a little too big to get out of the door of my studio. The Immaculate Perception. This piece is called Life For Me Ain't Been No Crystal Stare, but stare is spelled S-T-A-R-E. And, you know, I guess that's pretty self-explanatory. I don't have to go too deep. This piece is called So Clean and Articulate, and was done after hearing the comments about Barack Obama when he initially announced his bid to run for president. And I believe it was Joe Biden who said that, you know, here's a really clean, I've never seen such a clean, articulate black guy. And I thought that was really funny. So this piece is in reference to that. This piece may match your couch. you know, was another reaction piece to someone who was like, man, I really love your paintings. I would really like to get one, but, you know, I just got a couch and, you know, the colors don't, you know. This piece is called Be a Lion. This was from my show that I had in New York. And the line at the top, I don't speak Italian at all, so I'm not really sure if I'm pronouncing this correctly, but Meglio un giorno da leone, it means it's better to live a day as a lion. But the whole phrase is, it's better to live a day as a lion than 100 as a sheep. And, you know, so for me, I feel like in my work, that sentiment is definitely resonates with me. Like, you know, rather than, you know, sit around and wait for somebody to say, hey, here's a good artist, you know, I got to jump out there and show you. So it's about the bravado. It's about being a lion. It's about being bold enough to step out there and take on the world. This piece, I'ma Do You. I saw a show by an artist by the name of Barkley Hendricks. Are you guys familiar with Barkley Hendricks? He kind of hit his apex in the late 60s, early 70s, an African-American artist who did these really, really wonderful portraits of people dressed in the contemporary fashions of the day. And he used a lot of gold leaf in his work. And so he I saw his show, and that introduced me to the idea of incorporating gold leaf into my work, you know, which is kind of stuck with me over the last year. This piece is called Do Your Chain Hang Low? This piece is All That Glitters. And this one is Don't Feed the Mouth That Bites You. This piece is an interesting one. It's called Monkey Business, and this was in the show that was here at Conduit Gallery. Around the springtime last year, I got this email from a friend of mine about a cover of Vogue magazine that featured LeBron James and Gisele Bündchen. And there was all this controversy around this particular cover because people were saying that it was really racist, you know, that LeBron James looked very beast-like. They were comparing it to World War I propaganda posters that showed that was calling for American men to join the army to rescue, you know, white women from these savage beasts from around the world. The pose is almost exactly the way LeBron and Gisele were posed on the cover of Vogue, and this pose and this painting actually mimics that as well. But this piece kind of deals with that idea of the sort of underlying racism that exists between images of black men and white women together in media. So this was Monkey Business. This piece is Jesse Sphere, and this was done after hearing the comments from Jesse Jackson that he wanted to, excuse my French, cut Barack Obama's nuts off. The piece, people often think that kind of pixelation in the crotch area is something that I did in post, but it's actually painted like that on purpose. This piece is called Negro Scholarship. And this piece is Some is Greater Than Some. This piece sparked my series Stunned Like My Daddy, which was the show that I had in Conduit Gallery in the fall. I was invited by the museum a museum in Brooklyn to participate in a show called I Am a Man. And the show was 11 black male artists responding to what it meant to be a black man in America today, 40 years after the infamous I Am a Man protest in 1968. And I had this idea to do this piece, Some is Greater Than Some, and this is the title piece from that series. This is Stun It Like My Daddy. This is the title piece. Oh, this is also a title piece from the series. This piece is Warner Brother. And this one is PLD, which actually stands for Paul Lawrence Dunbar. He has a poem called We Wear the Mask, which talks about the sort of dual consciousness of African-American men in America. Like, you have to put on a certain kind of face, but underneath there's a lot of, you know, anguish and torment and stuff that you're also dealing with. So it's about having, you know, kind of living this dual life. This piece is called Olympic Torches, and this piece I did, this was based on an idea that I had from my travels. Often when I travel places and people find out I'm American, the first thing you'll hear is, oh man, what's up, nigga? And you're kind of like, huh? But then you start to realize that, you know, this is one of the biggest exports out of America is hip-hop music, and that this word is used a lot in hip-hop music. And so, you know, fans of hip-hop globally, you know, feel like, okay, well, that must be cool. That's acceptable. That's what it is. You know, that's what they say in the music. And so in this piece, I'm not necessarily dealing with that phenomenon, but dealing with the idea of this sort of exchange of ideas that happen, like how things are passed, how torches are passed, how communication and information is passed from an American perspective to around the world. And that's kind of symbolized in the wristbands that I'm wearing in both poses. The red, white, and blue for America, and the red, black, and green, which represents Africa. But this piece is called A Roof is on Fire, Olympic Torches. This piece, Barry and Bonds, deals with this really sort of interesting place that a lot of black athletes and entertainers find themselves in. You know, you're kind of put up on a pedestal, and then when the rug is pulled out, it's really pulled out. So this piece, Barry and Bonds, I like that name better than Michael Victim. This piece is called They Shootin'. And let's see here. This is In the Land of the Blind, a man with one eye is king. This was a commission piece. This piece is Liberation. And my new slogan now, my new favorite quote, is the object of the game is not to treat it like one. And that's the name of this piece. And this is I Know What You Like. So I also wanted to kind of give you guys an idea of the process of the work. I'm an avid magazine collector. If you come into my studio now, you'll find that everything is in a complete mess. It looks like a hurricane hit it, except for the place where my magazines are stored. And every place that I travel, I collect magazines. And So I start out with a particular magazine, and then I go into the photo shoot. And these images are from a series that I'm currently working on called Black Presidential, which examines this idea of the Obamas reshaping the images of black people in the media. I think that's a really interesting kind of thing that's going on there. And so I wanted to do a series that reacted to that. And so I did a photo shoot where I'm the black president. And so I would take, you know, my photo, and using computer Photoshop, I mock up a magazine cover, and then it becomes a painting. So this piece is called Un-American Idol. Let's see here. I just had a show in Cape Town, South Africa, and it was a great experience, a very interesting one. I arrived in Cape Town on a Monday. My exhibition was on Wednesday. On Tuesday morning, I go to the gallery, and they sit me down at the table, and they're like, hey, everything is great for your show. We have the invitations out. There's a couple of people from the media who want to come and interview you. We have an after party set up. We're going to have a great time. But your paintings don't get here until Saturday. So at that point, they were kind of like, well, so what do we do? And so I came up with an exhibition on the spot. And what you're looking at here is a study for one of my paintings. This is, again, it kind of shows you how I work. But I mock up the magazine covers. And I don't normally do this sort of drawing and marking over the images that you see here. But for the purposes of this show, I wanted to kind of work through some of the ideas that I wanted these pieces to express. And this series is called World Trade. So this is one of the images. And this is a detail. But the photos in this suite of paintings reference a photographer by the name of Malik Sidibe. So I did a photo shoot in his sort of style. And then I'll ultimately go in and paint these images just as you see them in black and white. But this the graffiti that you see on the pieces may change, but the ideas will be about the same. And last thing that I wanted to show you guys. When I was in South Africa in 2008, I did this series called Political, which is a series of screen prints of mocking political posters. So this one is Giuliani, Clinton, Bush. And Obama. So it was a lot of fun working on these pieces. You know, the idea kind of came from a conversation that I was having with my uncle, who was trying to convince me at this particular time. This was in late 2007. He was trying to convince me that Hillary Clinton was the one that we should vote for, because if she became president, then Bill Clinton could come in and, you know, do all this. But I was like, Bill Clinton is not running for president, you know. And so, you know, I found it really interesting, like some of the ideas that people had around politics that don't necessarily get expressed in the propaganda. And so I wanted to do a series of posters that kind of dealt with that. And last but not least, I'd like to show you guys another one of my video pieces, if you don't mind. And after that, I'd be more than happy to entertain any questions. I'll do pretty much anything but breakdance. But thank you guys for your patience. Let's see.
If he
wasn't a white guy in a good 5 to 6 inches taller, slightly more heavier than Muhammad. They might have had the same mom and daddy. I don't know. They just look just like me. Amazing. I'm getting in and just doing it. You can want
celebrity photographer, I am willing.
Shocking. They said everybody has a twin. We found problems.
And makeup stylist Shishi Renoir. I look at him and say, he reminds me so much of Mr. Pickles. It was something very touching, actually. It touched space in my inside.
Personally, I don't really see the resemblance, but you know, people are saying that it's that I look like him, so every little bit helps in the game. A game.
Well, Fahamu Peku is the shit. That brother does take some art, right? He does take some art and have these ideas and things about it.
It's like I could wash my clothes on his stomach or something. That's art.
Fahamu's amazing. You know, he's a sugar honey ice tea. He's the shit, baby. You know, and I really respect what he does. If I could paint, I would probably be doing what he does. But I'd probably just paint hair. We're going to wash your hair, we're going to set it, we're going to put some curlers in it, we're going to put your hair in the dryer, we're going to put a perm in it, and then we're going to take the perm out. We're going to braid it up, and then when we take it out, we're going to have full, complete different texture. All right, you're going to be brand new. You're not even going to recognize yourself.
Really? Okay.
I'm an artist. I'm a performer. When I'm doing your hair, I'm performing. If I could, I would have backup dancers. I would have background vocalists for what I do when I do what I do. When I start massaging that scalp and working those locks and teasing those tassels, you know, all you can do is just talk shit because it just feels so good. You just want to get angry. It's like eating some good biscuits. You just want to go slap somebody, mama or something. Yeah, it's just wonderful. It's amazing. This is going to be awesome. I mean, you're going to look great in this photo shoot. It's going to be amazing. Your family's not going to recognize you.
I'm ready to be the shit.
All right, here we go. Here we go. All right, here we go. And voila. Masterpiece. I feel like Michelangelo. The 16th chapter to me. Yes.
He's not perfect yet, you know. But after I get home, he'll be very perfect in so many ways. Yes.
She was great. She's really nice. You know, she's got a lot of energy. Felt like at some point, like she was kind of sucking my energy dry and taking it on herself.
You excited?
Yeah. She spent a lot of time talking about what she was gonna do.
I just need to feel your skin, see how it sits on your face. You know, what we do is make, we're gonna give you a magic lift there to wake you up. You see, because you look a little tired.
Yeah,
a little tired.
And again, like by the end, I was like, I don't really see any difference.
Come on.
I like to tell people I look like the world's only fat heroin. And I don't think that I don't look like that right now.
What's your name? What's your name? Yes.
Fahamu.
Say it with pride.
Fahamu.
This one.
I'm the shit.
Awesome. I'm
yes, Michael. So we're doing it like this, right? You know, I don't call people by their half name, Michael. It's Michael, right? After they finish the makeup and flip the hair and all kind of thing, I think now you need like a jacket, right? But not just a regular, like a sweet, real bright color, like an orange or something, you know? Bring out the bright color and not and just my...
Yudolphus was actually, he was pretty cool. He was probably the most judgmental of everybody that I worked with me today. He kept like looking at me and be like, just say, he's going to bring me up. You're going to bring me up. And I was like... Okay, I thought I would look like him unless he didn't bring me up and he just would shake his head like...
Look, black, wonderful. See, look, black,
wonderful.
Give me right, 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 right. Yeah, let's say it together. Blind, right? Wonderful. Right, right. That's just wonderful.
I got the right attitude, but I understand what I'm saying today. This thing, because it's just talking on and you know, I don't find pity.
The thing I learned today, you know, from my hair to makeup to fashion, is that it's all about attitude.
You're a little leprechaun man with no real head, but constipated. Yeah, man! But you're constipated. You're not moving that much. Yes. Give me.
So, you know, I got some attitude now, and I'm ready to be my own. I'm a one man phenomenon.
Has completed his transformation into Pahamu Pegu. We've taken him from bland to wonderful. Another success for our style team and another shocking transformation on Wannabe.
Yeah, it was fun. I had a great time. I mean, you know, Pahamu was definitely the shit. You know, it's good to be good to be the shit for a day, you know what I'm saying? I'm hoping that it gives me a little more confidence to go out there and talk to people and talk to ladies. And that's all in your head, you know? Women like confidence. And women like, you say, I'm the shit. So I'm going to go out there and say I'm the shit. And let's see what happens. And like I like to tell my wife, any sex I have outside of marriage is just practice for making love to you.
All right. So, yes. I promise you, you do not want to spend a day in my head. It's a crazy place. But yeah, that piece was done last year, and it was done in response to a really ridiculous program that comes on the TV Guide channel called Lookalike, where people who look kind of like a celebrity are brought in, and this team of celebrity stylists makes them over into the celebrity that they look like. Which I was watching it one night and I was like, this is completely ridiculous. What does the world come to? So that's me in a nutshell, guys. You know, I'd be happy to entertain any questions you might have. So. Yes?
I wondered about when you do the magazine title just the way it is, are there any copyright laws or how does that work? Do you get reaction from Art Review or?
Right. No, well, you know, I've been asked that question a lot, and maybe I've been lucky that nothing bad has happened. But as far as I understand, because I'm not actually doing a magazine with the same name, it's actually, you know, it's a painting, it's considered appropriation, that it's completely fine. And actually, most of the magazines that I have done that have been in contact with me, they've been like, oh my God, I love your work, I want one. So, you know, in a few magazines such as Art Lies have actually taken a painting that I've done and put it on their cover and stuff like that.
Could you talk a little, oh, I'm sorry.
I wanted to ask for how much does the Atlanta influence play a part in what you do?
Atlanta influence as far as?
The rich, cultural scene.
Oh, okay. You know, I think actually in a lot of ways it's not, Atlanta has influenced me in a kind of opposite way. I think that, you know, the type of work that I'm doing, because I was in Atlanta when I started doing this work, it stood out. It was, you know, really different than anything that was going on in Atlanta. And I think that caused people to take notice, you know, even outside of Atlanta. I feel like maybe if I had been in New York or something like that, you know, I might not have gotten, you know, the same kind of, you know, ground underneath my feet, you know, so to speak. But you know, as far as the scene in Atlanta goes, I mean, through my design company, you know, I've worked with a lot of, like, people in the hip-hop and entertainment industry, you know, designing a lot of collateral for them, which actually led to me creating my campaign. You know, I was sitting around making all these other guys famous, and I was like, hey, I should do this for myself. And that's how we kind of got there.
I was going to ask about some of the writing, the drawing, writing on, you know, I keep noticing the crown, which I assume is kind of a Basquiat reference. Could you talk a little bit about that process?
Sure. Yeah, a lot of it, like, for example, this one, "My grandmama hate it, my little mama love it," is a line from a rap song, you know. So, you know, again, it's the things that I'm listening to as I'm working, you know, and I might, you know, I'm kind of zoned out, but at the same time, something we might sneak in, and then I'll work that into a piece. There's a piece called Instant Art History Immediately, and I was listening to PS1 radio, and they have like this archive of like all of these artist talks and panels and all these things. And one of the panels was like from the early 1960s, and it was all these like really pompous, you know, critics talking a whole bunch of shit about pop art and how it wasn't going to last, and, you know, it was, these people just wanted instant art history immediately. I don't remember anything else from that talk except for that one line, but, you know, it's stuff like that. So, you know, as I'm in the studio working, like I said, you know, I often have an idea of kind of where I want to go, but, you know, it really kind of changes as I'm working. Like, little things come up, and I also, when I drive, it's like when I do my best thinking. And it's really dangerous, but I'll also take notes on a lot of these ideas on my BlackBerry as I'm driving. I read a long time ago, there's a rapper, Andre 3000, from the group Outkast. He talked about keeping like little journals, and, you know, when he hears like a clever line or like a catchy phrase, he'll just jot it down. And when he's in the studio making a song, he'll go through that book and you'll find a little line here. You know, and I find myself doing that as well. You know, so sometimes it's stuff that I'm listening to in the moment, but sometimes it's things that I've written down a long time ago. And, you know, there's little notes and sticky things all over the place. If you go through my phone, there's all kind of ideas in there, you know, so stuff like that.
I'm sure it's probably a little of both, but is it, do you ever get something on there and then recognize the association you created?
Oh, yeah. And it's really interesting. Like I said, like a lot of times those things kind of happen, and it's unplanned. And I really like those moments, you know, when things come together in a way. Like with that piece in particular, you know, because I don't speak Italian, but I wanted to write what I was going to say in Italian, I went on a website and just, you know, put in like Italian quotes. And I found that one particular quote, which I thought was really appropriate for that piece, you know. So stuff like that happens all the time.
One day you told me that after you did Surviving Basquiat, where Enrique goes, hey, no, that's not finished.
Right. Yes. Well, I get that a lot, actually. In the very beginning, I made a conscious effort in the beginning that I wanted to kind of show the process of my work in the work, you know what I mean? So I would leave areas unfinished. I would, you know, let the paint drip in certain places. I would not paint certain things. And I would get so much flack from my friends. They'd be like, you're going to have to finish painting in your forehead. Like, that just looks completely ridiculous. But I like that. I like that it stirred people, you know, so much that, you know, they couldn't really, you know, wrap their minds around, okay, why aren't you going to paint your leg in? Like, you look like you're an amputee. But I like what that does for me, and again, that kind of happens like really in a sort of happenstance kind of way as I'm painting. You know, I might be, you know, painting in a certain area, and I haven't touched the area adjacent to it yet, but the way the paint looks to the unpainted area looks really cool. So I'm like, I'll just leave it like that. I won't, you know, I don't want to force it to do anything.
Yeah, that's not what I was talking about. No, this was. You know, Surviving Basquiat is under your third painting, maybe.
Right.
And she's like, you say, hey, what do you think?
Yes, that's right. Yes, exactly. Yes, now I get you. Yeah, I had done the painting, but the writing wasn't there. And she was looking at it, and she's like, yeah, that's nice and all, but, you know, what? You know, it's just like, it's just a cool painting. It's a cool picture. And that's when I went in, and it was a, that piece, was, it was really sort of like a birth for me, you know what I mean? It was really kind of hard to mark on this painting, because I've taken so much time to paint it, you know, just the way I want it, and then to go in and like scribble on top of it was like, okay. But you know, actually after I did that one, then it became, you know, more and more. And so, you know, now I'll do stuff like I'll paint something in, and somebody come in and be like, man, you did a really great job on that hand. And I'm like, oh yeah? And I'll take a paintbrush and just wipe the whole thing out. And then it's like, you know, and for me, it's, you know, it's about breaking out of my own comfort zone. You know what I mean? So I don't ever want it to feel robotic. You know, I don't ever want it to feel like, you know, it's formulaic. You know what I mean? Like, just really let the painting do what it do. You know? So. Yes?
I'm sure because you're the shit. Did you talk about using yourself as the main character?
Yeah, for sure. Well, again, that kind of came out of this idea of the branding campaign. It evolved from the branding campaign. So, you know, as a way of branding myself, like, who better to, you know, represent this, you know, sort of idea than me? But using myself in the paintings has always been sort of controversial, even for me, because in a way, in a lot of ways, it's me, but it's not me. Like, it's a performance, you know, so there are certain aspects of my personal self that I never put into the paintings. For example, I never paint my tattoos, or I never take my wedding band off, but I never paint that into the paintings. You know what I mean? Like, stuff like that, to kind of create like a distinction between the performance and between real life.
Do you think that it's gotten closer to you as the series has gone on? I think the exaggeration that was in the first dozen or so paintings seems to disappear more and more with each one I see.
I think that's, you know, it's a fun thing in that what's real and what's fake is it becomes difficult to tell the difference, you know, which I think is really interesting, and it makes it a lot of fun. So. You know, I still try to remain very conscious of, you know, this character, and, you know, and then there's, you know, the kind of me. But I think in as I'm moving through, like, I think as I go out into public spaces, people are kind of looking for that guy to, you know, to show up. You know what I mean? And I don't know if he ever really does. You know, I mean, aside from the sort of costuming, you know, it's still me on the inside, you know. Yes. Oh, we had three. We'll go you, and then you in the back.
Can you talk about the willingness of others to be a part of the actual the co-stars?
Okay. Yeah, that's always a lot of fun. You know, all the people that you see in the paintings are like really just close friends, you know. I mean, it's literally like, you know, make a phone call to a friend who's a photographer and say, hey, I need to do a photo shoot, and I'll turn to the person to my right, like, hey, you want to be in the photo? You know, and, you know, we do it like that. But, you know, there's also brainstorming sessions. A lot of my friends, we'll get together in the studio, and we'll just, you know, sit around and shoot the breeze and, like, you know, kick around different ideas and stuff like that. So right now, all of my boys, everybody is really hot with me because they haven't been in a painting yet. You know, the girls are, they're good, but all my guy friends are like, dude, man, if you don't put me in a painting, I'm gonna cut you. And so part of, you know, what I'm doing with the Black Presidential thing is like bringing in my boys as like the Secret Service guys, so that they can be quiet. But, you know, it's always a lot of fun. And another aspect of introducing my friends and contemporaries into the work is also in the names that you see on the magazines. My mentor, and also he was my professor in college, Arturo Lindsay, used to talk about writing. He would say to me, like, you have to write yourself into art history. And so me putting my friends in the work is also writing them into art history. So, you know, my hopes is that, you know, 100 years from now, somebody's looking at one of these paintings and they see, you know, Wes Medlock, you know what I'm saying? They'll go and look up Wes Medlock to see who is this dude and how is he related and, you know, so on and so forth. And everybody continues to live and live and live.
You were saying that you don't bring this person in the painting into the opening. So, like, for those that weren't there last is that generally how your receptions are,
like,
kind of performances are?
Yeah, yeah. My performances are really, you know, almost improv, you know. I think that, you know, ever since the first event where I showed up with the bodyguard and, you know, the model, like, it just kept escalating from there, you know. I did a show, actually at Conduit, it got even bigger than it was when I had the opening with Bill in Atlanta. It was pretty kind of low key. We just had a red carpet, and I walked in with my bodyguard. And by the time I got to Dallas, you know, a VIP area was constructed in the middle of the club, and we walked in on a red carpet, and they sat me up in front, and everybody stood around and looked at me like I was on display. In New York, I had when I did my show, we rented a limousine, and there was, I think we were sitting on top of each other. There was so many people in this limousine, and we pulled up in front of the gallery, opened the door, and it was just a parade of characters. Like, I just had people dressed up in all kind of crazy outfits. So one guy was dressed up like King Kong, and he had a statue of the Empire State Building. You know, like, we just had a bunch of crazy characters pile out of the limousine. One of the shows that I did in Atlanta, I made a mock talk show. And so at the opening, you know, I arrived fashionably late, but I arrived to the host of the show being like, my next guest is Fahamu Peku. And then I come in from a back door and we walk up and we sit down, and he proceeds to interview me. But every time he asks me a question, I lean over to my friend who's my escort and I whisper in her ear, and she answers on my behalf. So, you know, I mean, like, like I said, every time, like, you know, I do a performance, like, you know, I have to kind of raise the bar, up the ante a little bit, and do something a little bit more fun and crazy. You know, I don't like to go to art shows and just kind of stand around and, you know, this is, you know what I mean? Like, I like to create a space where everybody feels like they're a part of the show. You know, it becomes really interactive. So, like, last night was a good example of that. Another show, something like a Phenomenon in Atlanta, that version, we took it back to the Harlem Renaissance. And I asked people to come dressed, you know, period, like Harlem Renaissance. And I, you know, I thought a few people would do it, but when I arrived, if you didn't come dressed in, like, 1920s vintage gear, you looked out of place. And we had live performances. It was a, you know, it was a great show, but everybody got a chance to participate. Everybody was a part of the show.
Right.
Yes.
I was going to ask what type of criticism you received and what you've been hearing from the critics, if there's been like a Fahamu is not the shit.
I haven't gotten that one yet, actually. You know, the criticism has actually been really, really favorable. I think, you know, I was talking earlier today with some friends, and I was saying, like, really the only maybe negative thing that I ever heard was a criticism from another artist who was just kind of like, I don't get it, you know. And he was just kind of, you know, trying to ruffle my feathers, you know. But, you know, for me, it doesn't, you know, I don't really get caught up in that. You know, like, I read the critiques like everybody else, and I'm always got my fingers crossed that it's going to be good. But at the same time, you know, I feel really confident in what I'm doing, and I think some people will get it and some won't. And even the negative stuff will lend itself to what I'm doing. There was a critique from my first show that I had here in Dallas, and it was a good critique. But when I first read it, I thought it was a bad critique, and it made me step it up even more, you know, because you can't go around and say you're the shit and not be the shit, because somebody will call you on it. So
I think you're brilliant. I would like you to talk a little bit about Black masculinity, because a lot of the pieces for me, it's like you're critiquing it, and I don't know if I'm, like, you know, stating the obvious or, you know, what your take on it.
Okay, yeah, definitely. I was interviewed by somebody earlier this afternoon, and he was talking about, you know, these sort of this sort of scale that I have in my work. Like, you know, you're critiquing things and embracing them at the same time, and how do you weigh that? Like, what percentage is critique, what is embrace? And I was saying to him, across the board, it's 50-50. So when we're talking about black masculinity, yes, I am critiquing it on one hand, but I'm also celebrating it on the other hand. But the series Stunted Like My Daddy in particular is me really dealing very, very specifically with black masculinity and how that looks in the media and in the world of fine art. You know, I think it's really interesting. I have to put this in a place where more people can see it, but I wrote like a really long essay on the subject, and it's titled Stunted Like My Daddy. But it basically deals with this notion that a lot of the impositions that affect successive generations of black men, or a lot of the impositions that affect me today have affected successive generations of black men. So, you know, some of the impositions that my father and grandfather had to deal with, I'm still dealing with, and how we can begin to change that. And the only way we can change that is by creating space for conversations. And so what I hope to do in my work is create spaces for those conversations to happen. So I'm not passing a judgment on black masculinity per se, but what I would like to do is create a space for somebody to rethink what they thought they knew about black masculinity, because I've been forced to do that. I've been forced to look at myself in a different light. After putting myself out in this kind of space, in this kind of way, people see me and people react to me in a certain kind of way, and I have to be very conscious of how I'm presenting myself. And so I want to create a space for those things to happen. But, you know, I'll try to figure out a way to post the essay, because I think it will, you know, kind of give you a better idea. I would hate to, like, just try to read it out loud or something like that, but yes.
Yeah, outside of your music and magazines, what are some things that, like, kind of fuel you or drive as an artist when you're painting or doing your work?
Reality TV, just because it's so ridiculous. I think that I'm like a sponge just to the world around me. Like, anything that's going on, you know, conversations people are having, things people are wearing, I'm pulling from all of these things all at the same time. Like I said, inside my head is a crazy place. It's never quiet in there. I can't really say like there's specific things that, you know, that fuel me. Like, it could be anything, you know, at any given moment, actually. Yes?
I think your work jumps way out of the black male boundaries and into the boundaries that young artists feel. And I wonder if you have any time to teach or work with young artists around the country.
I have done some, you know, like teaching, but I don't do it on a regular basis. And I've been asked a few times about being a teacher. And my response to that is always that I really feel like a teacher's real value comes from their experiences, and less than what they've learned in a book, you know. And so I feel like, you know, I don't feel like I'm at a point experience-wise where I can really, really, you know, impart some wisdom or knowledge on a young mind. I don't think you want to leave me alone with your children.
This is my first introduction to your work, and Bernie, he told me about your work, and so that's why it came out. And I think when I first look at it, I think one of the things I'm trying to do is how do I look at work and try to interpret what the artist is trying to convey. But sometimes I can do that pretty good, but I think if I had saw your work without hearing you talk, I wouldn't have said the same thing that you said. So to hear you speak about it is wonderful, and by the way, you're one of the best ones that have presented your work. I've come to these quite a few times.
Oh, thank you.
I do like it. When I hear you talk about it, it does come back to me and say, well, yeah, he's really putting himself out there, and he's really making a critical analysis of what is out there. Sometimes I look at it and it's playing with it, but saying, yes, it is still a strong image, and we have to recognize it and pay attention to it. the only part that came back to me, and I go, ooh, was when we're talking, you made a comment about the February, you know, how we look at Black history, and why is it those 28 days? And, I heard a little bit of, a little laughter in the room, which it is, it pisses you off. Mm-hmm. For me, it pisses me off. It's really not funny. And it's like, how do we, or have you thought about looking into the thought of why, or you like expressing it in your work, why we have to have that month? Because it has been so important.
Right.
To be recognized, and you had to fight for the week, for the month,
right,
to say, hey, I'm an American too.
Right.
So for me, that little part was like, how do you explore that part and carry it?
Well, I mean, I feel like it's, not to take anything away from Black History Month, you know what I mean? But at the same time, like, I feel like in my work, like, the ideas that I'm dealing with in my work kind of don't necessarily have to only happen in February, you know what I mean? So it's not to take anything away from it, but it's to say that these things go on beyond that, you know? Tom Joyner has, Black History Month every day, you know, like a different Black History Month fact every day, you know what I mean? But I feel like, as much as we, should, focus and pay homage to Black history, we also have to deal with Black now. And Black now happens every day. Like, it's not just 28 days in February, Yes?
How will Obama's election change you, do you think, and how you filter the world?
It's really I don't know that I can answer that specifically just yet. I mean, like, because it's still happening, you know what I mean? But one of the really interesting things to me has been that this idea that how the Obamas are reshaping the image of Black people in media, and I find that to be like really, really compelling. I was having a conversation with some friends, and we were talking about how, in the beginning when Barack Obama first, kind of emerged on the scene, and how, the media was like, wow, we've never seen anything like this before. We've never seen a Black guy who take care of his family and do, he's smart and he's articulate. Like, they were dumbfounded. Like, where did he come from? He was an alien or something. And, what was really interesting, though, was that that wasn't a foreign thing to me. I'd seen that before. You know what I mean? Like, I know that. I'm that. You know what I mean? So it's like, so I'm really curious, about that whole conversation and what that means. Are we now painting another very flat, one-dimensional picture of a Black man based on Obama as opposed to based on 50 Cent? You know what I'm saying? Like, where does the line divide? And so the series that I'm working on, Black Presidential, deals with that specifically. And what I've been doing is like a series of photo shoots where I'm recreating iconic Black images, but putting myself in as a Black president. So, it's Malcolm X peeping through the blinds, but instead it's the Black president peeping through the blinds. Or Huey Newton sitting in the chair, but it's the Black president. You know what I mean? So taking these classic Black images, but injecting the Black president into them and seeing what that says and does. So, yes.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And
well, I mean,
celebrities, I feel like, right, the same way. It's like they only look at. But that's what I think is interesting, is that you've created this character, and then it's on this flat, two-dimensional plane, but yet it's this actual person that has more depth and layer. And then you're playing with the magazine cover and the way that the media portrays this actual image, whoever it might be, on the front cover. And there's kind of a push and pull between creating this one-dimensional persona and also then commenting on how the media does that in general. And that's why I think it's interesting that you specifically only chose the magazines and not newspapers.
Right.
Or because somehow newspapers are more factual-based and this is more like a conceptual. It's like the editors going around,
right,
the table being like, oh, who should we put on the cover this month? It seems interesting to hear you talk about the political figures, and I'm also curious of when you say you went to South Africa and how the photographer you're talking about, how he does portraits,
mm-hmm,
and that for the portraits that he took, it was common, like it was basically people in the town,
right,
not
like celebrities at all, but yet those pictures are kind of idolized now.
Right.
And they become like the
aesthetic.
People look at
right.
them as like they're famous people in the picture, even
right.
though they're not. They're just like little kids that were playing in the studio.
Well, yeah, I mean, and I, you know, even beyond that, with the idea of the magazine, you know, I also think, it, you know, very specifically the types of magazines that I choose to put the work on also, you know, lends itself to the conversation. So, you know, I think that's, you know, one of the great things about this series. You know, very early on, a lot of people were looking at it and they were kind of like, oh, that's great. What are you going to do next? You know, and, you know, to me, that always said to me, like, that they weren't really getting it. Like, they didn't see it. Like, it's very multi-layered. It was never as one-dimensional or as flat as people initially thought, you know, when they encountered the work. And so I think, you know, as flat as you know, it is physically, you know, the ideas are so multi-layered. It's like peeling back an onion. There's, like, more and more and more to uncover. I had a collector who has one of my paintings. I can't remember which one she has. But the last time I saw her, you know, she was still glowing. And she was like, every time I look at it, I see something different. You know, every time I walk past that painting, I get something else out of it. You know what I mean? And that's a good feeling. You know, and I hope that all of my work has the ability to do that. Okay. One more and then, okay.
Yeah, a lot of my artwork like dealt with celebrity and Hollywood culture. I just was kind of interested to know what maybe how you keep your magazine persona and your bigger image like separated from your personal self. Like, how you keep the celebrity on magazines from your.
I'll tell you how. I have a bunch of friends around me who are like, boy, don't sit down. You know what I mean? I think it's really, you know, just about the kind of company you keep. You know what I mean? And you know, again, like in all of this, you know, it's serious, it's deep, but I'm also just having fun. You know what I mean? And the minute that I allow myself to get caught up in my own hype, somebody's gonna, you know, throw the cane and jerk me right back out. So, I unfortunately I have to wrap it up, but thank you guys. I mean, feel free to catch me in the hall.